Do you love freedom? Do you love being clean? Then you'll love Hero Soap Company, made in the USA. Chemical and fragrance free. A portion of each purchase donated to veteran and first responder charities. Initial subscription purchase is matched bar for bar and sent overseas to deploy troops. Let freedom clean. Hero Soap Company.
Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Today, my guest is Raymond Zamansky. Before I bring him on, just a couple of announcements. You can always get new episodes free on Rockfin, Odyssey, and all podcast platforms. Check us out on Rockfin. This is where you're going to get our premium content. You also get our regular shows and all the awesome shows from all the creators on Rockfin. Check out all the podcasts that we're featuring on the Forbidden Knowledge Network. Those are on our website, forbiddenknowledge.news, and of course, follow us on Facebook. All those links are in the description. Tonight, I want to welcome back to the show Raymond Zamansky. He is an award-winning author, researcher, and expert on Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and its alien connections. He retired in 2011 as a senior engineer and scientist from the Air Force Research Laboratory at Wright-Patterson. Tonight, he is back to discuss his latest book, Swamp Gas My Ass. Raymond, welcome back. How you doing?
Awesome. I'm happy to be back. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you back on. And I think it's been like over a year. It's been way too long. And like we were saying before the show, it's a completely different world that we live in. And we're actually, I think, witnessing a pretty obvious increase in people's interest in topics like extraterrestrials and UFOs, which I find very interesting. And it's like I said, it's been a while since you've been on, and you have such a really interesting background when it comes to your history at Wright-Patterson and some of the stories that you've had in your books. And last time we talked about your previous books, but if you could remind the audience about what was it that really led you down your path of extraterrestrial research?
Well, as you mentioned, I spent nearly four decades working at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and I think everybody's very familiar with that connection. Supposedly, the Roswell material was brought there. Aliens, if they existed, supposedly were brought there. And Wright-Patt has been continuously, you know, through the last 75 years associated with that phenomena. Well, I worked there for nearly four decades, and when I left, I was a senior scientist. But during the first week of my employment, I was assigned to a mentor who we'll call Al. And Al was a mid-level engineer. So during the first week, he wanted to show me where the coffee shop was. Now, our setup in that building was there were two-story office buildings, and in between them was a hangar about 250 feet in length. And this is a massive hangar. It's where they would repair airplanes or, augment airplanes for testing. A huge hangar. But at that point, in January of 1973, it was empty. So we leave the first two-story business office, which is where we were located, and we go down a short ramp, and we're in this building, and it's dark and empty, and there's nothing in there. And you can see the big girders that support the roof, and there's just nothing but darkness. So we're walking through, and he turns to me, and he said, "Have you heard about our aliens?" Well, I'm a 19-year-old co-op student from the University of Detroit, so I don't know aliens from Jack. So I said, "Hey, you know, we have this conversation," and he tells me, "Well, there was a crash out west, and they brought their machines and their occupants to Wright-Patterson for evaluation and exploitation." And I was like, whoa, stunned. So it was at that point where I said, something's going on here. Well, as time went on and, you know, the days and weeks are moving forward and I'm a co-op student, I start meeting more and more people because Al, as my mentor, is introducing me, you know, to Doug from accounting and somebody else from this department and just handy people to know that are, you know, near my age or recent college grads. And every time I had a chance, I'd ask them, hey, Al told me about having aliens in the tunnels, man. What's all that about? And they'd go, oh, yeah, we've got aliens here at Wright-Patterson. Well, come to find out that Project Blue Book had been there for over 20 years. And it was hosted at Wright-Patterson at the Foreign Technology Division. And pretty much everyone to a person knew about Project Blue Book. They didn't really know what they were up to, you know, and it kind of took Blue Book's words. There was nothing going on. But for me, that was the start. You know, Al mentions aliens. Everybody's kind of backing up his story. And though I didn't take it all in, you know, it wasn't hook, line, and sinker, it got me thinking. And that's really where it all started for me, right there during my first week at Wright-Patt.
Now, based on some of the testimony that you've heard from employees and then various people that you've encountered at Wright-Patterson, what are some of the, I guess, most profound but lesser known stories that, you know, we may not have heard of? You know, we've all heard about the, of course, you know, Roswell stories, but what are some of the lesser known Wright-Patterson stories?
You know, there's probably 1,000 stories. There's 25,000 people, 8,000 acres, over 600 buildings. Do you mean specifically to...
Well, the most profound for you.
Well, obviously, there's a couple here. And the first one has to do with whether or not alien bodies were brought to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. We know that whatever material was picked up in the desert outside, you know, 75 miles northwest of Roswell, you know, 30 miles outside of Corona, we know that material came to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And how do we know that? Well, Jesse Marcel, who was the intelligence officer of the 509th Bomb Group at Roswell, called Roswell Army Airfield in 1947 when he was there, he was tasked by Colonel Blanchard, who was the head of RAAF, to go out to the Foster Ranch and pick up all of this metal. So he and Sheraton Cavett, another intelligence officer, drove up there, spent the night. Next day, they got as much as they could in their car, drove it back, was examined on the base, and then they wrote the story. They said, hey, we got a crashed disc. But it was Marcel who was tasked to get on the plane and take that material to the 8th Army Air Force headquarters in Fort Worth. So he personally escorted it. When he got there, it was a photograph of him, you know, holding what was not the material he brought. It was a weather balloon that they had brought in, you know, crunched it up. And then at that same office was a man by the name of Thomas DuBose, who eventually became a general. But that moment in time, Thomas DuBose, General Thomas DuBose, was the chief of staff for the 8th Army Air Force, where the material was being delivered. Later in life, he signed a legal document that said the material that was here that came out of Roswell was not of this planet, to his belief, and that material was sent to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. So whatever that material was, there is no doubt, it is indisputable, beyond debate, that material went to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base for evaluation. Now, that information goes all the way back to, you know, 1947 when it happened, and in the late 70s when Stanton Friedman first uncovered Jesse Marcel, probably about 1978, and got his testimony recorded. So that connection is indisputable. Now, there's this alien connection. And I have never found any convincing testimony by anybody that has convinced me that aliens were part of the delivery. And here's why. If they came in at the same time as the materials, Jesse Marcel would have said something to it about it to Stanton Friedman in 1978. He would have said, A, we had alien bodies, or B, part of the material that we shipped there, there were caskets involved. Now, it was his job to escort whatever came out of Roswell. So as the official guy, he had to know what was there. He never said anything about aliens. In fact, it is my belief that the first mention of aliens in Wright-Patterson came off the lips of Glenn Dennis, who, if you remember, was the embalmer. Some people call him the undertaker there for Ballard Funeral Home. You know, he was an employee there. And I think in the late 80s, he had mentioned to some researcher about those caskets. So that alien connection to Wright-Patterson never became an issue until 1989. Now that's 41 years after it happened, after, you know, the Roswell crash, and not a single Air Force person who was in that chain of custody loop, like Marcel or General Dubose, had ever mentioned aliens. So for me, and I hope everyone else out there, and I'd love to be proven wrong, for the Roswell crash, I think the aliens were something that might have just been a periphery story, or if there were aliens and Glenn Dennis did indeed source small little caskets, they were shipped somewhere else at a different time and were not on that B-29 or whatever Marcel used to bring that silvery material to Wright-Patterson. I'm really squishy on that whole alien thing. So despite the fact that, you know, people joked about aliens being in the tunnel and that sort of thing, it just seems less real to me than the things that we can prove with the materials.
Now, other than the story of the alien bodies or the material, is there anything more modern that you've heard of that could possibly have occurred at Wright-Patterson or maybe even underground in these alleged underground bases?
There is documentation, and I actually do a lecture called Haunted Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Now, this lecture is based upon information that I've been able to collect from base employees who experienced it. These are the firsthand witnesses. Now, how did that all come about? Well, it must have been well over a decade when, you know, you remember the ghost hunters? There's the TAPS guys, the Atlantic Paranormal Society. You know, they became famous. They're still famous. Well, they came to Wright-Patterson to do their three-night ghost hunt. And they staked out three different buildings, one each night. And the reason they did that is because, one, there were newspaper articles, which I have copies of, and there were a couple of witnesses, recent witnesses, who knew each other on the base through their jobs. They had to interact. And they got to talking, and they said, wouldn't it be cool if we got the ghost hunters here on the base? So they wound up doing it because the base commander at the time was really open-minded. And I wish I could remember her name at this point. But so she invited them onto the base. Well, it turns out that at one point in my career, I spent 2 years working as a direct report for a different base commander, a Colonel Spacey. And Colonel Spacey, because he was the base commander, the two women who were the ghost witnesses were still associated with his office because one was the head of protocol. If the president of the United States comes to the base at Wright-Patterson, that woman, before she retired, she was the liaison. Her office was the liaison between the U.S. president and Wright-Patterson. So she was a very prominent person. But I knew her personally. The way that happened is, while I was working for the base commander, I was the director of the civilian wellness program, the installation civilian wellness program. So I was a direct report to the base commander, and I had given that woman and her staff a personal tour of the fitness facility and had those experts also tour them around. The objective was to get that group, that singular group, interested in what their own personal wellness. But I did that for the entire Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. So I had all 12,000 civilians under my purview for that aspect of it. And we ran these base-wide wellness programs. The point is, I was at the top of the food chain at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, working directly for the base commander, and was one of only a handful of people who had the capability and the right to send out an email to the entire base population. So I knew a ton of people, and everyone on the base knew me. So when I started to investigate stories of this paranormal, when the ghost hunters came on, a lot of people came forward and told me their stories. I also discovered when I did the first lecture that a woman in a base newspaper article who was one of the, she provided the testimony on all of her occurrences with these paranormal entities, her granddaughter got in touch with me and said, I heard this thing on Zoom. You were talking about my grandmother. I was in the building and I had paranormal experiences. Her story had never been told before. So she gave me her phone number. We hooked up and I had her as a guest on some of my Zoom presentations, which I did on Haunted Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. So here's the catch. Here's this little hookup. The building where her grandmother was working was Building 219. Building 219, not at the time her grandmother worked there, but at the time of some of these stories, and in 1947, it was the base hospital. And if alien bodies had been brought to Wright-Patterson in 1947, they would have 100% been processed to Building 219, because that was the only place on base that had a morgue, had operating facilities, had doctors, nurses, had x-ray machines, had all the diagnostic tools, had everything you needed to store the bodies, to examine the bodies, to do autopsies, to do evaluations, and all in secret. And that was the building where there had been decades of paranormal experiences by employees as the building went from a hospital to a pediatric clinic to being the housing, to being an office space for the Foreign Technology Division, the same guys that did Project Blue Book. So that was, for me, one of the coolest things, is to go in, and I actually had office space in there for a short time when there were some renovations going on when I was the wellness guy, and I had stored some stuff in. It was only a couple of weeks, and then I had left some stuff in there, and we stored giveaways and t-shirts and whatever. So I had cause to go in and out. And so present day, people that I work with, like at the USAF Marathon office, whose office used to be next to mine, and I was in there all the time, they told me stories, which I rolled into their paranormal experiences in Building 219. So, and then the interesting thing was, when the ghost hunters were there, that was one of the buildings they didn't get a response in. That was probably the most paranormal rich building on the base prior to their attendance, but it was a one night thing and it just didn't show itself. So for me, that's kind of cool, because that never got attention until, and we'd have to look it up when the ghost hunters were like, and had to be like, I want to say 2008, maybe, right around there. And I should know, but I do hundreds of talks and I've got all kinds of forms of them. I just don't really remember dates that well. But for me, beyond the alien things, even though this has a potential alien connection, I think that's one of the coolest things about Wright-Pat, is this paranormal history. And there's two other places where the ghost hunters did find paranormal activity.
Now, I'm glad that you're bringing up the possible connections with paranormal activity and extraterrestrials. Lately, I've had quite a few people on, and I've been just talking in private to people who are trying to put these connections together. And one gentleman said that he has encounters with crafts, and then after the craft leaves, he will have paranormal activity in his house. And this, you know, this happens in quite a few locations like Skinwalker Ranch, Blind Frog Ranch. There are these places of high strangeness and seemingly high energy that seem to have these connections to paranormal and extraterrestrials, which I find very interesting.
What type of experiences are they describing after the craft depart?
Well, the gentleman I spoke with was said that if he had poltergeist activity in his house and things would move and he may see like shadow people after a craft encounter.
Well, think about the high electromagnetic field that these things generate, and, you know, radioactivity, for example, or, you know, they might be cleansing their ship and they're dropping used boron that's, you know, was used to control radioactive processes on the craft. So those things may, you know, be stored somewhere within the building. I don't know, just off the top of my head, how that electromagnetic energy would be stored, but, you know, maybe they got a dosage of it and, you know, it temporarily affects the brain waves. You know, we know that's possible. And we know that's proven. So maybe, you know, that's an issue. Or I've seen some recent articles about a gentleman who's doing research about those who have been in the vicinity of craft. And he's looking at their the brain CAT scans or MRIs or whatever they're using. And he's finding deformations which shouldn't be there, which means the brain has been physically altered. So I think there's a lot of ways that, you know, energy that's being transmitted off those craft could cause hallucinations or loss of balance or, you know, temporary blindness or loss of hearing, those sorts of things.
Right. Yeah, man, that stuff is super interesting. Now, I want to get into your new book, Swamp Gas My Ass. Now, this tells the true story of a 1966 Michigan swamp gas UFO case. Now, for those in the audience that really aren't familiar with this, could you give us an overview about what happened?
I will. And I'd love to. In fact, the coolest thing is I have a connection to this. Because I was born and raised in Detroit. Now, Detroit is about, this was, you know, near the city airport. So as the crow flies, you know, it would probably take about 45 minutes to drive westward from where, you know, I grew up to the area where all these UFOs were appearing over a 3 to 4 week period. Now, this is like Dexter, Michigan, Hillsdale, Michigan, Ann Arbor, which is, you know, the largest city in that territory. So, and also just another little background, where I grew up was about 20 miles from Selfridge Air Force Base, probably even closer, maybe 15 as the crow flies. So, if you can imagine a triangle where Selfridge Air Force Base is here, Ann Arbor is here, and the house I'm living in is over here, just kind of a strange shaped triangle. But in 1966, in March, hundreds of people were seeing UFOs, multiple UFOs. Occasionally, they would see a single UFO, which would be joined by a second, and then two more. They would fly off in unison. And the witnesses were dozens of police officers to start with. And they were filing reports, you know, said, hey, you know, the desk sergeant, we saw this, you know, some took photographs of it. Hundreds of citizens saw these. Well, every time they called Selfridge Air Force Base, which was the closest Air Force Base, and a very important one at that, in 1966, Selfridge had two F-106 squadrons, the 71st and the 94th. And they were important because the U.S. Air Force thought that the Russians, if they were going to bomb the U.S., would come up over the North Pole through Canada, and the first place they would fly into would be New York or Michigan. So there were fighter interceptor bases in those states. So while this UFO activity was going on, people were calling Selfridge Air Force Base. And initially, the public affairs official at Selfridge said, yes, we've seen the objects too, but they didn't pose a threat. You know, they were here and gone, so we didn't scramble airplanes. And then the lid slammed down. That's the only occasion and only one quote where a newspaper man by the name of William Tremmel got a quote from Selfridge Air Force Base public affairs official admitting that these things were flying around. Now imagine, you know, Selfridge and the place where it was happening was within an hour's drive. So it's a blink of an eye for a UFO, right? Well, the local officials, since they didn't get anything out of Selfridge, they decided to do two things. First, they contacted Project Blue Book and said, you guys need to hear about this. And they also contacted their local congressional representative, Weston Vivian, who in turn contacted Gerald Ford, who was the minority leader in Congress. So he's a powerful guy. So after several days of getting stonewalled by Selfridge and those officials and Battle Creek, which was the control center, Blue Book sent Dr. Hynek and a couple of airmen to investigate. And imagine now, one of the incidents was a gentleman by the name of Frank Manor and his son Ronald. On the 20th of March at about 8:30 in the evening, they were living in Dexter Township, which is about a mile north of the little tiny hub of Dexter, Michigan, as we know it today. And they saw what they described as a fireball coming out of the sky and stopping. They thought it was a meteor, and it stopped at the treetop level and hovered. And then it had these lights that blinked. So they saw it go land, and they ran out. And they got within a couple hundred feet of this. About 500 feet is the best as I can determine. They got so close that they could tell what the texture of the outside looked like. They could tell where the positions of the lights were, the colors of the lights, what kind of sequence. These boys were right on top of this thing. So when they said something to each other or moved, that one blinked out, and 500 yards away, another UFO blinked on, and they went, and you know, they were unsure, you know, they only saw one thing come down. And what they probably didn't know at the time was there were multiple UFOs in the woods at that time, which is going to be proven out in a minute. They went back to their house to call the sheriff. He was already on his way because people in that area had seen this, and they sent the sheriff to the manor's home because they said they thought it landed right in his backyard. So Manor was one of the principal witnesses, his son. There were a dozen sheriff's deputies, police from Dexter Township, the city of Milan, and they're all running through the woods for up to 4 hours with flashlights. And they get close to this thing, it would blink out and it would peer on the other side of the woods. Well, after about 4 hours of chasing this, one of them pops up out of the woods, hovers over a car of a Dexter police officer, a Honeywell, who's on the north side of this property at which all this activity is going on. You imagine a dozen sheriffs and police officers chasing these things with flashlights, and they're popping up. And so Officer Honeywell sees it there, and he's got a witness in the car with him, who he describes later and he identifies. And he said, after about 15, and he's watching the flashlights in the woods. Another one pops up, so he's got two over his car. Two more come out of the woods and join up, and they just rush off out of there. And of course, he files an official report. So dozens of police officers, eyewitnesses. The next night, a UFO appears on the campus of a university, and there are 90 witnesses, including a man who was the director of the local civil defense office, because his wife worked on the campus and she made sure that he got called because this thing was public safety for the area. So he gets called, and they watch this craft hover over the local arboretum a few hundred feet away for up to 4 hours. So all the, and there were two police officers who filed a report because they were called to Hillsdale College. They saw this thing at close range and it sped off, and their report synchronized with the witnesses at Hillsdale College about when this thing disappeared. Lots of corroborating evidence. The congressmen are on it. The police are reporting it. They send Dr. Hynek to investigate. After 3 days of investigation, he has a press conference with radio stations and 60 reporters in the Detroit Press Club, and he says it was swamp gas. It was swamp gas. Oh, of course, everybody blew a gasket, and President Ford said, this is bullcrap. So on the 5th of April, he called the Secretary of the Air Force. He called Dr. Hynek. He called Major Quintanilla, who was the head of Blue Book, on the carpet. And they all had to fly to Washington. And on the 5th of April, a congressional inquiry was held. And guess what happened? They said, we want to know what happened in Michigan. And they told them, well, sir, we're sticking with our swamp gas story. So they lied to these guys. And then they made a BS about, oh, the weather was so conducive, it was perfect for creating swamp gas. I went back to the official weather records. It was exactly the opposite. They had thunderstorms there. There was high wind, and it was too cold for swamp gas to collect. They lied about the witnesses. They lied about the testimony. Literally, the congressional testimony is there. And when you read what the witnesses said and you compare it to what the Secretary of the Air Force and his cronies told Congress, it's a pack of lies. Now, fast forward, and that's where the story stayed. That's where, you know, the phrase, it's only swamp gas came from.
Yeah, that was it.
Now, fast forward to January of 2020. Without giving away any trade secrets, I discovered a witness who was stationed at Selfridge Air Force Base in March of 1966. And he was a pilot assigned to the 71st Fighter Interceptor Squadron. And when I found him and told him who I was and what I wanted to discuss with him, he said, okay, let's set up a meeting. And we did. And he said, it's about time, I need to tell someone this story. So I went over and I met him. And one of the first things I discovered is he was suffering from terminal cancer. And so he knew his time was limited. He passed on the 18th of November of this year. So I got to spend a full year interviewing him and finding corroborating evidence for his story. And here's what he's told me. He said that in March of 1966, he and a friend in the squadron, Bob Nicholson, they were captains. They were on what was called 5-minute alert. And the klaxon went off. And that meant in 5 minutes, they had to hit F-106s up in the air trying to find the bogey. And they would be vectored to that bogey by the control center in Battle Creek. So they got into their planes, and he was the first one off. So that made him the mission leader. That made Bob the wingman. And for 45 minutes, they were being vectored around because people on the ground and radar had alerted the authorities that there was something unidentified flying in the skies at that time. And so within 45 minutes, they had located this craft. It was silvery. It was described as football shaped, which, you know, kind of resembles a disc if you rotate it right. And he told me this amazing story of chasing this silvery craft around southeastern Michigan for 45 minutes. and having it in his windshield and verifying the visual sighting with his wingman and verifying the fact that both of them got hits on their radar, which were recorded for posterity. So swamp gas my ass, which is this little beauty right here. And, you know, it must have been something deep in my mind and, you know, buried a long time ago, because I didn't notice it until just now. And I'm going to share this with you. The coloration of my book is eerily similar to a book that I love here by Bud Hopkins.
Oh, you're right.
And I did not notice that until I pulled this book out for this show and tell today. I went, yeah. Oh my God. It was, how strange.
What a synchronicity. Yeah.
Yeah. this is just really crazy.
Oh man. Yeah. Very close. That's cool though.
I did not look at books for inspiration, but that's the way it happened. So let me tell you about Colonel Carroll, because he's the hero here.
Yeah.
He became a full-bird colonel. That's one step below general. In the book, he gave me permission to publish his entire official DD-214. So the readers are going to be able to look at that and say, I can establish that he was at Selfridge Air Force Base between this date and that date. I can establish that he had over 5,000 hours as a pilot. Over 4,000 of those were in fighter jets. The same thing with his wingman. I do not have his complete DD-214, but I have the essential portion that shows where he was, when he was, and what he did for a living for the Air Force. I also have excerpts from a previously classified National Security Agency document, which was classified top secret ultra and has now been heavily redacted, but portions of that document that weren't redacted, I use it as corroborating evidence for other exploits of these two pilots. And so not only do I cover the true story of the swamp gas UFO, but I cover some good segments of both of those individuals and show the reader how important they were to the national security of the United States and how skilled they were as jet fighter pilots. So that's my latest endeavor. And I think, you know, you get all these guys out here that, you know, they're talking disclosure, but not really disclosing anything. They're just regurgitating a discussion or giving you their opinion of, well, I think that 9-page report by the Office of the National Intelligence Director, but they're not revealing anything. Well, what I want your audience to know is swamp gas my ass is disclosure. It's the word, it is testimony, which I took from over 30 hours of recorded testimony, and I excerpted and I made transcripts, and it is in there, not all 30 hours. It is a man who kept a secret for 55 years and chose to reveal it to me and gave me permission to reveal it to your audience.
100%. Yeah, that is the true disclosure. It's the people who've had these experiences and, you know, the whistleblowers, the contactees, that's where the truth lies. And we all know what the truth is already. But I was going to ask you, you brought up this kind of modern pseudo disclosure, whatever the hell they think is going on. But what do you feel about this narrative that they're kind of portraying since 2017 with the New York Times article? Then they throw a little bit more out there and then reel it back in, swamp gas, throw a little bit out there, reel it back in, swamp gas. And they did it big time recently. Now we hear silence. No one's talking about UFOs anymore in the news or the mainstream. So what do you think is going on with this kind of weird UFO narrative lately?
Well, I can understand the criticism of the process, having been inside a government and know that at times it can move like a glacier. I think the 9-page report has been highly criticized, but people who criticize it really are short selling it. They either Are personally not satisfied with it for some egotistical reason. You know, I'm the guy always on the TV talking, and, you know, I'm allowed to criticize it. Let's see what they said. For me, it's mind-blowing because I never thought, and I have to go back to all these interviews that I did before and take back what I said, because I said, I don't expect anything like the disclosure that they put out there in my lifetime. So let's think about this. Here's the three top things that you can derive. They said these objects display technology which far exceeds ours and any of our known adversaries. Okay, so that's a crazy admission. Then they said it is definitely a safety of flight issue. That's a mind blower. And then they said, it is possibly a problem of national interest. Our national security is potentially at stake. If you put those three things together, what they said to me is, flying saucers are real. We are very concerned. And we need to do something about it. But you have all these people, and you know, notice the guys who are criticizing things. Hell, half of them are Canadian citizens. So their vote doesn't count, or they're expatriates out of who knows where, England or whatever. Sorry, your vote doesn't count. You know, this is Americans for Americans by Americans. You might live in this country now, but as far as I'm concerned, you don't have a vote. I think it's mind-blowing revelation. It's just mind-blowing. Basically, flying saucers are real. And now people complain, well, it's going to go in the intelligence agencies and we're never going to see anything. Well, that might be with good reason. If you don't like it, go back to Canada or the country you came from. They already admitted they got you that far. I mean, obviously now there has to be more pressure put on, but how can you discount what they put in that 9-page report? That was massive. That's a major paradigm shift over the last 75 years.
Yeah. And do you think that possibly within our lifetime, we could see a shift from we don't know what they are, they are unidentified craft, to they are craft for off-planet species or extraterrestrials or, you know, aliens, whatever they want to choose to label the occupants of these ships? Do you think that the narrative will ever shift to what's going on inside? Who's driving these things?
You mean the narrative of
the official? Yes, the official narrative.
You know, I'm not on the inside, but I know what the narrative is. Hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people know what the narrative is. Do we need the government to tell us what the narrative is? I don't think so. I mean, I wrote the last book of the trilogy came out a month before, and nobody knew what those 9 pages, you know, were going to contain. And I wrote 3 books that listed my position. We've been visited. We're being abducted. We're being used as, part of a hybridization program. I put those things out there. Hundreds of other researchers have posited the same thing. And now what happened? The government said flying saucers are real. Do we need the government to tell us that? I don't think so. I don't. Right. I don't. Yeah. 'Cause if I do, I'm 40 years ahead of them. I just think that, you know, they've got to see what the response is to everything as they get it out there. And, you know, let me put you in their position. What if I told you, Chris, tomorrow morning you have to perform brain surgery at Bonsecours Hospital? I've just anointed you, your new job, and you're a brain surgeon. Well, of course you can't do it because the patient will die. Imagine, you know, these earthbound people who just happen to work in the government and have technology that has been shown to be obsolete compared to what they've seen, you know, Tic Tac and Go Fast and all these other gimbal guys.
Right.
Now they have a job they can't possibly do. who wants to get out there and go, oh, yeah, we're working on it. You know, there's a lot of pressure. And this is what Colonel Carroll said. He said the reason that the government, when he was flying, didn't want it to leak out is because the taxpayers and the congressmen who were already going crazy during that time, right? Gerald Ford was out there. Representative Vivians was out there calling Blue Book every day saying, we give you all of this technology and you can't tell me anything about the adversary. Why am I doing this for you? Who wants to live under that pressure? So I don't envy these guys. In fact, I'm shocked that they put out that report. I'm absolutely shocked that they made that much of an admission. It's a, for me, it's a mind blower. It's case closed.
Right. Well, now you also mentioned hybridization programs and the possibility that we have been involved in these programs for a long time. And I've had plenty of guests that believe the same thing, and I'm definitely entertaining that as well. Do you think that, first of all, how far and how far back do you think this has been going on? And is this a nefarious agenda or a positive agenda? What are your thoughts on that?
In my second book called Victoria's Secret Truth, it's a 2-year case study that I did on a woman named Victoria and her family. And Victoria has conscious memories of contact. A lot of her memories were buried behind screen memories. And so she had 4 hypnotic regressions with 3 world-class therapist, twice with Dr. Leo Sprinkle, who unfortunately just passed, once with Yvonne Smith, and once with Barbara Lamp. And between the 3 of them, they have probably done, just using the numbers from each, several thousand regressions on individuals who claim to be experiencers. So they're the cream of the crop for this type of investigation. And using hypnotic therapy, they were able to bring Victoria's recollections out of the subconscious to the conscious level. And those were recorded during her hypnotic sessions. And those recordings were given to me to use for the book. And in discussing this with Victoria, she admits that she is part of an alien hybridization program, that they have taken her eggs and they have used them to create entities. Now, why they're doing that, I did not explore. My job was to establish the fact that something was happening, was to evaluate the best I could those video recordings and audio recordings that were given to me, to discuss the same with all 3 of the therapists. In fact, Dr. Sprinkle wrote the foreword for my book, Victoria's Secret Truth. And he praised the book. He praised my approach to the book. So I got a lot of good support from him. And he totally agrees with my conclusions. He was able to review the manuscript, edit it, give me comments, that sort of thing. Barbara Lamb has read the book. I've gotten 2 thumbs up from Barbara Lamb. I've gone over the manuscript with Yvonne Smith in great portions, not the entire thing. I have gotten her support, her approval of my conclusions. So looking at other things like Dr. Jacobs, who wrote, Walking Among Us, that sort of thing, it would appear as if there's a very advanced hybridization program, and the purpose of which appears to me to be creating entities that have advanced capabilities. Maybe they'll live longer, eat less food. Maybe they're more have more empathy for preserving Earth, whatever. And establishing these people in our population and having them breed with us and pass on those genetics and create a whole, upgraded humanity through this program, rather than, trying to grab everybody on the planet and alter their genetics. It appears to me to be supplanting human nature, the human population as we know it today.
Do you think that we may be involved in some kind of nefarious agenda to alter humanity?
I don't think it's a we. I think the visitors are doing that. And that comes through the evidence of the people who are part of the program. And Victoria is maybe one of hundreds of thousands who have done that. You know, you got to read the other works of people who've come long before me, you know, the Bud Hopkinsons of the world and the Dr. Jacobs of the world and Barbara Lamb and Yvonne Smith and those types, mentioned Dr. Sprinkle. All of those people have put out books and saying, hey, this hybridization program is real. Nothing's being done. It doesn't appear to be as it's disturbing anybody in authority. Mm-hmm. And, you know, why not? And again, mine was just a really narrow slice where I wanted to look at one individual and I wanted to examine that and see what I could discover. And if her story is true, and I believe it is based upon the evidence, then she's just one of many.
That's really interesting. Now, to close out, I want to get your insights into what some people call Men in Black. And if you've had any encounters or heard any profound stories about these entities and your thoughts on what they are, if they're just a faction of the government that's not known, or maybe part of a hybridization program, or maybe not even human at all. What are your thoughts on the Men in Black? And if you personally had any encounters?
Yes, I've had encounters. And I think the Men in Black are human. I think they're intelligence agents that when it was necessary, before this June 25th proclamation, and when it was necessary to fully cover up the best evidence, photographs, whatever it might be, intimidate witnesses into silence. There was a group of individuals who were tasked with stealing the evidence, obfuscating it. If it got released, discredit it somehow or discredit the individuals. So I believe they were a real functioning group. And one day I had an encounter with a person who, it just struck me the way they were dressed and the fact that they were literally standing outside of an intelligence agency building. Had I seen this person at Walmart, I would have thought, oh, early Halloween costume. But the fact that they were literally standing outside the Foreign Technology Division building, that would be the first place that I would expect somebody who works for the Men in Black to be stationed, because they're the guys getting all the input on where all the evidence is. It'd be like, okay, we call Major Quintanilla of Project Blue Book, and yeah, okay, here it is. And next thing they go, he taps on the wall and goes, hey, slips under the door, hey, Mr. Men in Black, this is a Kecksburg thing. You need to get out there. So it's perfect. It's literally a perfect place for them to be housed, would be in a building like that, because it also housed the unit that was getting all the first calls for where all the evidence was. It absolutely perfect. So I had a discussion with them, and that discussion and some of my thoughts on the Men in Black are in my first book, which was originally called 50 Shades of Grays, but has now been revised the title Alien Shades of Grays. And that's all the books are on Amazon. But yeah, I've had encounters with Men in Black, and somebody actually sent me a photograph of another man in black entering the Foreign Technology Division building, which I thought was pretty cool. So, and I've already displayed that. So if you guys are thinking of coming to my house and grabbing it off my, it's already out there. It's in the wind. It's all over the internet.
Yeah, I just haven't heard any recent accounts of Men in Black lately. I'm wondering if they're still, around and doing their thing.
Well, I suppose if they still have a purpose, they might be doing it. And it's probably obfuscating the truth or spying on people like me who've written books, that yeah. contain secrets that were held for 55 years by an American hero. They might be doing that. And in fact, when I was prepping this Zoom thing, my software caught somebody tried to sneak in a Zoom Trojan on me.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and my software caught it.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, you know those.
Yeah. So, but it is what it is. I don't believe I've revealed any secrets, especially now. Colonel Carroll was worried early on about telling me the secret. but he did. And, you know, we delayed the release of it for over a year. And it was released just before that 25 June. You know, we released it in April. But he thought, hey, nobody ever told him to keep quiet. He was never sworn to secrecy on it. He was never approached by Men in Black or his superiors or anybody to say, don't talk about it. He just did because, you know, he knew it was a sensitive subject. And he told no one until he told me. And I know that to be a fact because I was with his son at a talk I gave here in Ohio, and his son attended. And afterwards, his son got up to say a few words to the audience. And his son told the audience, I had asked my father multiple times if he ever saw a UFO, and he always told me no. And the first time I heard about it is when I read Ray's book.
Wow.
So he didn't even tell his family about this.
Wow, that is so interesting. Ray, thank you so much for coming on. Before you head out, I'd love for you to tell the audience, if they're interested in finding your books, more about you, what's the best way that they can do so?
You can go to Amazon and look for Alien Shades of Grays. It's a trilogy. And if that doesn't get you to it, add a word, type UFO in, and that'll get to it. My last name's too hard to spell. If you have anything that you want to send me, you know, any interesting stories, I'll contact you. I may or may not follow up because my curiosity is satisfied, but my email is itsaufo@yahoo.com. And that spells itsaufo@yahoo.com. And you can send me something, you know, I know I've heard all the wild stuff, but, you know, you might get an email back from me if it's super interesting. But my plan from here on out is my curiosity is satisfied. I don't care about any more research. I'm going to do a few shows. I'm going to do a conference, maybe some local library talks, but I'm pretty much done with this. I'm good. You know, I want to move on to something else.
Mission accomplished.
Metal detectorist. I'll go search for gold coins on the on the Gold Coast of Florida.
Oh man, that sounds nice.
Yeah, but I'm pretty much done with the UFO thing.
Oh well, hey man, I'm glad that you feel that's mission accomplished. There, you've definitely accomplished a lot in that arena, and I thank you for your work. And I thank you so much for coming on tonight. Fantastic information, and we'll have to do this again sometime in the future.
I'll tell you how many gold coins I found.
Yes, and maybe you might get abducted in the process, and you can tell us about some firsthand experiences. You know?
Oh no, thank you. I'd rather write about it.
All right. Well, Raven, thank you so much for coming on, and I'd love to talk to you again soon. And until next time, everyone, have an excellent evening. We'll talk again tomorrow.